So our meditation tonight was really just a kind of a glimpse of a practice that kind of involves letting go in a concrete way. You kind of begin to notice all of the ways. Did you feel that during the meditation? The sensation of letting go of this sense of self that we build up that is comprised of our roles and our responsibilities and our relationships, and just seeing what that's like to kind of play with that a little bit, play with what it would be like to let that go. Because it seems like so much of our practice and the techniques and the strategies that we use in our meditation tend to be in service of learning how to get comfortable with dissolution, with change, with transition. There's many different words for what I'm talking about. Sometimes they're big, sometimes they're small, just these uncertainties. You may have noticed that as well in the meditation. Just sometimes it's a relief, and let go of worrying about that project. And then there's some edginess or tension that has a tendency to creep in at the thought of really letting go. Okay, maybe for just, you know, the next 30 minutes. But total letting go, I don't know. That's a little edgier. There's often a little bit of an existential anxiety that accompanies this idea of letting go. And so the retreat that I'm going to be leading in October is the talk tonight. They're kind of related. We're calling this Navigating the Everyday Bardos. And so bardo is kind of defined as a gap or a space in between one thing and the next. Sort of one thing ends, the next thing begins. And typically, traditionally, it refers to that gap or the space in between the death, the ending of this life, and the beginning of the next one. But in reality, bardos are gaps and spaces between everything, including this life that we're living right now is a bardo between birth and death. And then there's just from the large to the small, just that gap at the end of the breath before the body takes the next breath. There's this moment of uncertainty. Will the body breathe again? Because we know that one day it won't. Now it is. But there's this sort of unconscious, imperceptible moment of uncertainty. So there's big bardos and there's little bardos. And I kind of want to spend some time exploring all of them tonight and how this can really, how the practice of working with these uncertainties is really kind of the key to awakening. So it's, I just find it to be, it has a lot of legs, this practice. You get a lot of bang for your buck with learning these practices. And so, of course, death, we consider an uncertainty or something that happens. This is a big one. We lose a loved one, or we're confronted with a scary diagnosis. You might bring to mind something in your own life. From the moment we find out until life picks up again, isn't there just this gap of uncertainty? We're not sure what to do in this space. The rules that govern our everyday life no longer apply to whatever it is that's happening now, these big events. So sometimes in our culture, we think of this as like having the rug pulled out from under us. People will describe, just blindsided. Often we're surprised by the fact that the way we thought it was, it's not like that anymore. Other times we have a little bit more notice, but often these things just really kind of have a tendency to catch us off guard and we feel unmoored, ungrounded. And they're sort of interruptions in our normal sense of certainty. So to be a little bit more precise, a bardo refers to that state in which we've lost our old reality. It's gone. It's dissolved. And a new reality hasn't quite come together yet. I love to think of it's September. I live in Virginia. I'm sure the same is probably true in Maryland. It's monarch butterfly season. So anyone have milkweed in their yard? You're watching some chrysalises? Is that the plural of chrysalis? It's fascinating, right? They make these really cool green chrysalis. Someone's going to tell me what that word is. And, you know, something totally different comes out. And we've probably contemplated this before. What in the world must it be like, right, for that caterpillar? It actually liquefies in there, totally dissolves. I mean, I was using dissolve as sort of a nice visual for you, but this caterpillar completely dissolves and then turns into something else. The caterpillar has the benefit of not knowing what's coming, right? Which is not the case for us. So in reality, we don't know what's coming, but we think we do. And that's kind of the sticky wicket of this human life, is the ways that we think that life is predictable and is going to go as planned. So these in-between states, they're often really edgy, and they're just such fertile ground for practice because, well, we have no choice. They're going to happen. And even in this life, these bardos are happening all the time. And you can kind of replace the bardo's a Tibetan, usually comes primarily out of the Tibetan tradition, but they just, it's an immense trove of practices. So we'll just be kind of exploring a tiny slice tonight. And so we talked a little bit about the big ones, the dying of our loved ones, and certainly our own death at the end is what we're preparing for. So much of Buddhist practice is in preparing for this moment of death. Yet during life, we have these moments all the time. And so aside from the big ones of the health-related, sometimes our life changes in a moment and can throw us into this uncertainty for something like a betrayal of trust. We thought we knew someone or a situation or a group of people, and all of a sudden, wow. And now we're in this uncertainty. And now, gosh, I thought I knew this person. If they could do that, then do I know anybody? Right? We can kind of be thrown into this existential crisis of we trusted our intuition. And we trusted I'm a good judge of character. And all of a sudden, wow, we're blindsided. The rug's pulled out from under us. What do we know? And it's this wanting to know, having to know, really, that creates this solid ground under our feet, which we know is not really there. We may know that from, we've read about it. Maybe we've had some meditation experiences where we've really, I personally experienced this kind of oneness and groundlessness. Yet when it occurs in our everyday life, it's like, wait a second, it's not what I planned for. Sometimes it's a sudden trauma or an accident. Something unexpected can put us in the same place where what we thought we knew is no longer true. Remember, it's this, we've lost our old reality and we're in this new reality. Everything's changed from that moment on. Even in the slightest way, it really kind of messes with us, with this sense of groundedness that we have. Other times it's a life stage. So you can be, you know, traumatic experience free for your whole life, but you will hit the point where you will probably retire, right? Your old way of being is not the new way anymore. This can happen. Sometimes people lose jobs, and then they're in this bardo state of not knowing. Sometimes this happens when kids leave the house. I'm not there yet, but I will be sooner than I know it. And wow, we know it's coming. We're like, not the caterpillar. We know it's coming. But it's this dissolution. Talk about a dissolution of roles or a changing of the role. And what do we do now? We can feel lost in this place. Sometimes, well, I probably almost all the time this happens with the dissolution of relationships, divorces. Something we thought was solid is no longer there. And here we are. And this is the new way that it's going to be. So we can use these times that have a tendency, they have a tendency to be fraught with unease, even though often there's a butterfly waiting at the other end. We by design, we don't know that in the moment. We can't feel that in the moment. And this is just the nature of things. So it's a great practice with these things that are occurring during our life. How do we get comfortable being in the discomfort? Being in the soup of edginess and like, ugh, some of us want to check out and just go to bed. Other times, busy, busy, busy. We're going to distract ourselves from this reality that's uncomfortable. I don't know what to do with these circumstances. And of course, this is practice for the final dissolution at the end of our life, where we lose the literal connection to this physical body, which in the Buddhist tradition is not the end. It's the dissolution of this physical body. And this wakeful presence is unchanging. So this wanting things to stay the same, expecting that we know what's going to happen and what to expect, is really part of our DNA. It's part of being human. And no matter how much, you know, spiritual study we do and we read and we practice, it's kind of not personal that this will come back over and over again, this noticing that, God, I thought I had, you know, had this down, this transition, being in flux. I thought I was better at handling this. And it's not personal. It's going to happen every time. It will arise. And it's really how we meet that challenge of being in the in-between. I think that has a tendency to shift over the course of our life. And certainly, this meditation practice is one that's extremely helpful because we can practice ahead of time. So I'm going to read you, usually try to stay away from longer readings and evening classes because I know how that goes. But I found this to be really interesting. So I'm going to paraphrase with apologies to Bruce Tiff, the author of the book Already Free. Well, maybe that's a plug for his book too, so he'll forgive me. And I'm going to skim this and paraphrase a little bit. But he says, from a Buddhist point of view, our commitment to not feeling yucky emotions gives rise to a very convincing sense that we have some central, essential nature, that we're actually in charge of this show, and that our lives seem to be formed around something, and that something feels deeply problematic to us. By practicing our avoidance strategies over and over for decades, I mean, this is really what we do as humans, we become convinced that there must be a central thing around which our life revolves. And that center is composed of our vulnerabilities, which are perceived as problematic. So this is, I'm reading this because he really just elucidates the problem of being human. Our whole life revolves around a problem, and this problem must be who we are, because it's always been there and it never seems to change. So these vulnerabilities, we don't seem to get mastery of the vulnerabilities. We kind of, you know, ebb and flow with them, perhaps. And this belief serves us because it means we don't have to consider the possibility that there is no center to our lives, right? That's the key piece. No independently existing self, which is edgy. It's an edgy thought that there is no self. So instead, we spend our lives in therapy and spiritual practice, trying to heal or take care of this problematic self that we've created. But as we begin to dissolve this sense of having an essential self, and absent this struggle, we show up each moment and just deal with life as it happens. So this dissolution of this illusion of this central self that's problematic is really what being in the bardo is about. So the Tibetan sage Milarepa, who was quite a character, so he was a man who in his early life was a murderer, like murdered lots of people, and felt bad about it. Again, paraphrasing. felt bad about it. found a teacher and did a lot of instruction and meditation until he freed himself. And he was a little bit of an oddball in that he liked to spend time in a cave, and he was known for his singing. So I won't sing for you tonight, but he referred to this dissolution as a great marvel, singing, "The precious pot containing my riches becomes my teacher in the very moment that it breaks." He's singing joyfully. So we're not usually singing joyfully when we hit that place where the pot breaks. So this notion of a rupture, it's sort of like poking through the veneer or snapping out of the virtual reality that we usually find ourselves in our day-to-day activities. So this notion of a rupture is vital to our awakening, and that the cause of all our suffering, as we know in this tradition, can be boiled down to grasping onto this fictional self that Bruce talks about in his book. So the precious pot shatters, and everything we hold dear rolls off the table like marbles. So reality as we know it is disrupted, and this game that we're playing with ourselves of this contrived self-concept is suddenly irrelevant, and we're kind of shocked out of this virtual reality. And it's really helpful when we're talking about these kind of, you know, esoteric concepts to think of a concrete time in your own life when you noticed that this was true, when something happened where it was, we were either kind of shocked out of the old reality and into something new. So one that comes to mind for me was about 15 years ago, my family was in a car accident. We were hit by a drunk driver, and it was a two-lane road that goes around a lake, right? So we were on the lake side and bending to the left, and the driver was coming around this way, and she just crossed the line and just hit us head on. Now, thankfully, those lake roads, they're, you know, like 15 mile an hour roads. I don't think she was going 15 miles an hour, but I was driving. And so many things kind of stand out from this episode. The first being that and it was 2 a.m, which is, you know, when these things have a tendency to occur, and dark and drizzling, and we were a mile away from my in-law's house. We were going to visit them. And I remember driving, and as she is crossing over the line, I remember thinking, wow, she's crossing over the line. And then, of course, impact. And just this total rupture of everything the way it was. So we had a 6-month-old baby in the back seat, my dog, husband. She's driving this big truck. I'm in my little Honda Accord. Wow. I don't know if you've ever been in an accident that's shocking. It's kind of weird. So there's shocking for real. Shock kind of prevents you from getting too worked up about things because your brain does something where it kind of goes into a different place. And so I remember, you know, wiggling my toes good, hands good, a little bit of blood, yeah, it's okay, baby good, dog good, husband good. Wow. And then the lights, and it was just sort of this kind of out-of-body experience, and oh, look, Jaws of Life, you know. Wow, and the lights. And so the fireman came over and, I mean, are you okay? And I just remember saying, but she crossed the line. And and I always thought, you don't cross the line. Did you not see that yellow line means you don't cross it? Like, I don't worry when I'm driving on a 2-lane road because everyone stays on their own side. Until they don't, right? Oh, right. This rule that I thought was just a rule that everyone abided by was just this concept in my mind. Oh. And then, of course, this in-between state of not really knowing how I was, and I turned out I was fine. I needed some stitches and slightly traumatic, but it had a happy ending. Even for the driver who actually turned out to be a little worse off than me, but not much. And I didn't meet a hole. Just all these things that are kind of coming through in this moment of rupture. But then after that, when I drive on a two-lane road now, I don't assume people are going to stay on their own side. And isn't that interesting? So I find myself in this tension all the time. You know, I spent, I don't know, 36 years, I guess, at that point. No one crossed the line. So now I play a statistics game with it. But this is our habit. This is our mental habit as humans, to try to then put the world back together with all the rules and boundaries that keep me safe, that keep this self safe. Another example that I remember hearing from a friend about the dissolution of the way the world works was I ran into a friend the day after the election in 2016. And she was just like, she was walking her dog on my street and she just like couldn't speak. I can't even quote her because that was her. And I finally was like, get a hold of yourself. What's going on? She's just, I just can't. I mean, dissolution of the old way, making room for this new way and this unknown. Well, what does this mean? Everything I thought I knew about human nature and yada, yada, gone. So you can maybe think of some examples in your own life. And those are, of course, things that we know come and go, right? This dissolution, it's always dissolving and re-upping and dissolving and re-upping. But of course, when someone dies, when a loved one dies, or we're diagnosed with a serious illness or a terminal illness, don't we suddenly see how silly our regular complaints and annoyances are? And how visceral the present space is. The spacious presence. We're kind of knocked into this moment where everything kind of stands still. And even though it may be something unwanted that's put us in this place, there's almost this surreal feeling to it that's not altogether unpleasant, right? The unpleasantness comes when we start to tell the stories about what it means that this has happened or what it means that I have this diagnosis. But in that spacious presence, it's just connection to our moment-to-moment experience. So this juxtaposition of the real and the unreal is sometimes really stark. And that's sort of the beauty of Bardo, is that it snaps us out of this habit of being on autopilot that dominates our everyday lives. So when we suffer a disruption like this, we find that we just can't play the game anymore. And sometimes that lasts. There's lots of people who have gotten a cancer diagnosis and they survive. And they're just not putting up with any of their priorities become kind of crystal clear. This is something that we hear over and over again. We're going to give up the game that we've been playing really before this without even giving it a second thought. But when we're forced to give up control, when we're forced to a tipping point where we're severely ill or in hospice, or we have to give control over our own body to other people to take care of us, holding it together is not an option. And it feels terrible, this breaking down in those moments, the letting go. So it's this raw, kind of broken, open state. But there's a relief in that as well. And that's what we can explore in our meditation practice. This letting go of all manipulations and contrivances. We practice a little bit in our meditation tonight. There's actually a great sense of relief available to us, knowing that we don't have to do that anymore. We don't have to be that anymore. I have a friend who was going through a divorce, and everyone was surprised. No one had any idea that there was any problem in the marriage. And until she kind of announced it, and it was like 6 months after the fact, they had moved out, and I just remember her saying, oh, it's such a relief. I was so afraid to tell people because of what I thought they would think, because we had the perfect marriage and the perfect kids and the perfect life. And it's such a relief now that this rupture has finally happened and I'm finally telling people, you don't have to, you know, play the game anymore of happily married person, perfect kids, that nothing ever goes wrong in my life. So we practice for these times for when we're no longer able to manage our outer image or to kind of, you know, pursue the ideal self. And it's just how it is as human beings. When things fall apart, it's pretense and striving fall away, and life becomes very, very simple. We become liberated from our storylines. And so this practice, this meditation practice of letting go of storylines, is one that you can do regularly. I love to sometimes just begin or end a meditation practice with this dropping everything I know to be real, and seeing what's there in the absence of who I think I am, sort of this primordial vibe that we can tap into. And because it feels a little edgy, we get used to doing it little by little. Oh, what's it like to kind of swim in this primordial soup of not identifying with anything? The Indian sage Krishnamurti wrote, "When the mind is still, tranquil, not seeking any answer or solution, neither resisting or avoiding, it is only then that the mind is capable of perceiving what is true. And it is the truth that liberates, not our effort to be free." It's that last part that gets you, right? It's the truth that liberates, not our effort to be free, not our wanting to be free, but our ability to kind of approach the truth of this non-existent contrived self. So we learn that the game can be given up. And that when it is, that emptiness that we feared, this void, is really not what's there. And what is there is this bare fact of being, which can be experienced as a boundlessness, a simplicity of presence. It's a really wonderful way to look at it, the simplicity of presence. And we experience this, you know, we can experience this when we're watching a beautiful sunset or looking into the eyes of our child or our dog, the simplicity of presence, nothing else, no other responsibilities or stories intruding. Just breathing in and out, waking up, chopping wood, carrying water, going to sleep, our compulsive striving, just letting that subside. Sometimes in that ungrounded space, when something difficult happens, we don't even have the energy to comfort ourselves. We can't tell ourselves everything is okay because we don't know. And we might be too tired to even try. We're just waving the white flag. And what remains in those moments is this spontaneous presence meeting us again and again. So we never drop that thread of awareness. We're not alone in that emptiness. We have this thread of presence, of aware presence that doesn't come or go, sort of this continuous present. And yet, it's really hard to do. That's why we practice. That's why we sit in meditation and go on retreats and explore all of the various things that are hindrances to our meditation practice, that are hindrances to letting go, the ways in which we feel attached, the storylines that we care deeply about, and that we're not willing to let go. And so it can be kind of disconcerting to know that this is the task at hand, that you know, we don't really want to lose our relationships or lose what we know to be true. So fear kind of brings us to the role of fear in in working with these transitory, these transitional stages, these bardo stages. So fear is a natural human emotion that has a lot of roles, some of them beneficial. But in spiritual life, the arising of fear can mean that we're getting closer to the truth, which is that there is no ground. And again, then the edginess, that nothing is certain. So I have this postcard that sits on my desk that says, relax, nothing is under control. And that was a joke that someone got for me because I have a tendency to be a little on the controlling side, but I just felt so relaxed when I read that. I was like, just imagine if I didn't have to control anything. Nothing's under control anyway. Have you noticed? Part of me believes it, and then part of me is like, well, who's going to be in charge of this if it's not? Oh, okay, nothing's under control anyway. So the root, this is something I find really fascinating. The root etymology of the word fear is fare, F-A-R-E, like a ticket or a toll, like a price that has to be paid in order to discover the truth. Fear as a fare, so this marker of authentic growth. So fear is supposed to be there. It actually means we're getting some traction. So fear is the sort of underlying mood of the egoic or contracted self, the autopilot self, the emotional expression of suffering. And in the Buddhist tradition, this is connected to our ignorance, the ways in which we just don't understand the way things are. We just don't understand that nothing is permanent. We don't understand that suffering is a part of life. We don't understand that it's because we're clinging to so tightly is why we're suffering. We have this sort of veil of ignorance. It's not personal, but it can be worked with. And when it's unconscious and stays that way, we try to get rid of it. We give it a lot of energy. And sort of trying to get rid of our vulnerabilities is, we give so much energy to it that it kind of becomes our egoic center of gravity. So then everything has a tendency to orbit this primordial fear, really, of staying alive and being okay. And it's mostly not conscious. And so we kind of go through life circumambulating around this suffering. And it's in working with that fear as it arises, that edginess, all the flavors of fear, that we practice with learning to be comfortable with the discomfort of knowing that there's no solid ground, right? The saying that the bad news is you're falling. The good news is there's no ground. So we can kind of, it's a little spacious in this falling. There's a lot of elbow room in this falling, but there's no ground. This is sort of the relaxed, nothing is under control. So the extent to which we kind of understand this nature of reality as boundless presence, all of it, the good, the bad, the ugly, is the extent to which we can relax. And so I'll say that again because it's kind of important. The extent to which we understand this, the true nature of reality, which is not these little contracted cells, is the extent to which we can relax deep down, not at the beach, but like the soul relaxing that we're so longing for. It's why so many people come to meditation in the first place. When we know that, when we can feel that awareness and that present, anything becomes bearable. We kind of cultivate this heart that can handle whatever comes our way. We get really intimate with that groundlessness, that we can have sanity when life is hard, even when we know the experience is going to be painful. So we're the caterpillar. We know something weird is about to happen. Maybe it's painful. I don't know if it's painful to dissolve in a chrysalis, but it's painful usually to lose a loved one. But we know it's coming sometimes. And if we can stay in the moment, in that presence, that instead of jumping ahead into the what ifs and what does this mean, we can be in connection with what's in front of us, with what's happening, which touches into the heart of compassion that is such a fundamental part of this practice. And if we get pretty good at that, with all of the blips that happen in this life, perhaps there may be ease and comfort even in our own dying, in our own dissolution. So the Bardo practices are meant to guide one from the dissolution of this body and all of the layers of this body and into the next life or into whatever comes after, because there's a few options. It's not all the next life. And it's really fascinating to read that Tibetan book of living and dying. Presence emerges in the Bardo as the ground of being. And so because we get that on some level, like some of the things that I'm saying tonight, maybe they really resonate. Yeah, I get that. And yet, how strong the habit is for me too. I'm definitely not up here as someone who has this 100%, but that goes back and forth from this deep understanding and experiential understanding through various life events to contracting so quickly out of habit. And so the wonderful Tibetan teacher Pema Khandro Rinpoche talks about this habitual grasping, even though we know better. She says, in this way, we experience ourselves over and over as both confusion and wisdom, a treacherous and fantastic situation. We taste the ground here and there, but we can't ingest it, which creates a dramatic friction, one that gives rise to all the mental poisons as a means of coping with this chronic cognitive dissonance between open ground and contracted being. This is the way it is for most of us. This open ground, contracted being. We're going up and down and up and down. Without some way of managing this experience, we never know if we're going to show up in the next moment as a Buddha or a demon. We're like God's one moment, tasting the fruit of the kingdom, and hungry ghosts the next, not able to swallow it. How confusing and how fantastic. This confusion is the raw material of wisdom. So the fact that this happens, it doesn't mean we're not doing it right or we're not there yet. It's part of the plan. It's how we cultivate this raw material of wisdom is in noticing that contraction. This is where mindfulness comes into play. We're aware that we're aware. And we can notice things. We can slow down the experience so that we feel the contracting coming on. And then, we can work with it with some of the skills we're learning that we've learned in our meditation practice. So the first essential point is rupture. And the second is giving up the game. And the third is this recognition that our actual ground of being, our inherent nature, is this dynamic, responsive, boundless presence. And so if there's a goal here, it's to know that ground and become intimate with it, familiar with it, learn what it feels like, what it tastes like, what it smells like, and learn how to relax into that inherent peacefulness that's available there, the peacefulness of not knowing what comes next. That kind of sounds like an oxymoron, right? The peacefulness of not knowing what comes next. We don't really usually relate to it that way, but we can practice relating to it that way. We practiced in the meditation we did tonight. Just residing, resting in this space of not knowing, of not identifying with all of the various things that are part of this life. And when we do, and the extent that we do, everything changes. We're no longer slaves to this kind of primordial anxiety that's there. So there's a funny teacher, activist, Glennon Doyle. Some of you might be familiar with her. She shared something recently that I thought was really funny. She said she was being interviewed by someone. At the end of the interview, the interviewer said, "Well, what's next for you?" And she said, "Well, I'm going to walk my dog." And there was like an awkward silence. And the interviewer said, "No, like professionally, are you going to write another book?" Or she said, "Well, I just do the next right thing. And then I do the next right thing after that. And that takes me the whole way." And it just reminded me when I was thinking about this, about how we're freed when we don't have to know exactly what's coming next. We can just walk the dog. And after we get home, something else is going to show up that needs doing, or someone that needs tending to, or ourselves, our own heart that needs tending to. And so Pema Chodron, who is an American Tibetan Buddhist nun, who we love and writes really prolifically about this idea of no ground and of things falling apart. So from her book of the name, When Things Fall Apart, which you might want to get your hands on if you don't have it already, she says, "Things falling apart is kind of a testing and also a kind of healing. We think that the point is to pass the test or to overcome the problem, but the truth is, things don't really get solved. They come together and they fall apart. Then they come together again, and then they fall apart again. It's just like that. The healing comes from letting there be room for all of this to happen, this spacious presence, room for the grief, for the relief, for the misery, for the joy." And so our culture doesn't really like dissolution. It doesn't really allow for it. It's discouraged, right? We're kind of told to pull yourself together, to, move forward. And I think that when we see someone else dissolving, that it mirrors our own existential anxiety. And so how often do we want to just tell someone, in a nice way, of course, to just pull it together? That, oh, this will pass. It'll be back to normal before you know it. Like, we're projecting our own wanting solidity because we're seeing, oh, wow, if this could happen to them, this could happen to me. So this moving on, oh, just be thankful for what you have. Keep moving. Distract yourself. Things will get back to normal soon. We don't really have rituals for dissolution in our culture. And some of you maybe come from cultures that do have rituals around dissolution, around mourning, giving time for things. There was a day when people would wear armbands for 30 days or longer after the death of a loved one, so that everyone would know they're in mourning. And, I mean, what do we give ourselves these days? If the person dies on a Friday, you're probably going back to work on Monday, right? We do 3 days? Yeah. So we don't have the structures in place that really support this unraveling. And we're marking the passage of time. There's no sort of rites of passage for children as they get older, for aging. And this has a tendency to fuel that anxiety because society is telling us that we should just be able to do it the way we used to do it. And we should have these kind of expectations that things will get back to normal. So I'll just close by saying that even though these unravelings and these dissolutions, sometimes they really blindside you, like the car accident. Sometimes we see them coming. We have months or years to anticipate the death of a loved one. And that if we're careful, we can notice, if we're mindful, we can notice when we start to contract into the storylines about what's happening. And the difference, the visceral difference in the body and heart when we drop that storyline and are just present with things the way they are. Just being with someone who's at the end of their life can be a wonderful experience of connection and intimacy when we let go of our attachments. And so, again, we can practice with this. This experience of dissolution can be wildly freeing. We can let go of this kind of psychological heaviness, this kind of accumulated weight that comes along with our usual momentum of life. So to walk the Buddhist path is to kind of dedicate our lives to abiding in that impermanent, empty, visceral presence, that boundlessness. And when I say dedicate our lives, it doesn't mean that we spend every moment of our lives in that boundless state, but we have a concerted effort to remember that that's our true nature, is not who we think we are in our titles and all of these various things that society expects of us, but that we can reorient ourselves to let go over and over again into that boundless presence that's quite supportive. And then we can bear those losses that we know we're inevitably going to face with a greater ease and wakefulness, right? When we're lost in a story about what's happening, we're not there. We're not awake to what's right in front of us, which is so tangible. And then it's possible, you know, when our own death draws near, that we can relax with ease into this ground of being as we finally let go of this body and experience liberation, sort of being in this undefended, groundless space. So I hope that that's helpful. In the next time you find yourself kind of in one of these bardo states that's uncomfortable, that maybe first you notice the ones that aren't so uncomfortable, right? These in-between states that happen when you're parked in your driveway and you're getting out of the car, but you're not in your house yet, right? That's a transition moment. It can be unknown. You don't know what's going to be going on in that house, right? What's going to need your attention. You're boundless. You can relax into that state. Anytime we're transitioning, anything can happen. So we can start to pay attention to those times and let go of expectations and see if we can be present with things the way they are. And then when the harder things come along, seeing if we can practice it then and then and then all the way through to this final dissolution. So I want to thank you for coming tonight. It's been my pleasure. And I hope to see you again. Thank you so much.